This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to This is the Place, a podcast channel from The Common Magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Nariman Yusuf about three pieces she translated for the recent issue of The Common. Nariman Yusuf is a Cairo-born, London-based semi-freelance literary translator. She holds a master's degree in translation studies from the University of Edinburgh, manages a small translation team at the British Library, and curates translation workshops with Shadow Heroes. Her literary translations include Inam Kachati's The American Granddaughter, Donya Kamal's Cigarette No. 7, and contributions in Words Without Borders, Banipal, and the poetry anthologies Beirut 39 and The Hundred Years' War. Nariman Yusuf, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Emily.
Would you begin by describing where you're calling from and what it's like there and sort of set the scene for us?
So I'm in my home in London. It kind of feels like late summer again. 2 weeks ago, it felt like we were already entering winter, but we've had the blessing of another like burst of warm sunshine the last few days. I'm sitting at my desk where I've worked for most of the past year and a half. And it's one of those buildings that have four sides with a courtyard in the middle. So where my desk is located, I can kind of see into all the neighbors' windows and they can see into mine. So yeah, so I've become very familiar with the neighbors' schedules over the past year and a half.
What area of London do you live in?
In Kentish Town.
I studied abroad in London and then I lived there for a couple of years and I lived in Kentish Town when I first moved. Back. I've always been a North London girl. Yeah.
So we could have been neighbors.
It's such a nice part of London. So to start us off, I'd love to have you read a few paragraphs from one of the pieces that you translated for the issue. And it would be great if you could read it in the original Arabic first and then do your English translation.
Sure. So I'm going to read from Latifa Barker's piece, Adam's Apple, and Latifa Baka is a Moroccan short story writer. I think she has primarily, if not only, written short stories. She's published three collections that I'm aware of, and so yeah, I quite admire that her loyalty to the form, because right. Because that's yeah, it's quite, it's what I love translating short stories as well. So I really enjoyed translating this one. And I'm going to do my best to read the first couple of paragraphs in Arabic and then English.
Great.
تفاحة آدم لطيفة باقة. دخلت فوجدت النساء هناك في القاعة الواسعة. سمعت أصواتهن الرخيمة بما يعني أنه ليس هناك رجل. العبارة الصحيحة هي ليس هناك رجل يتكلم. أتقدم نحوهن بشكل غريزي كحيوان يعثر أخيرا على بني فصيلته. أخذ مكانا وأجلس لانتظار دوري قبل أن أصعد إلى عيادة الطب النفسي. كنت قد صادفت لبنة سريعة أمام مدخل البناية بعينيها الناعستين اللتين يفيض عنهما الكحل دائما وشعرها الذي أصبح أشقر. كانت تتحدث في الهاتف وترتدي لباسا جلديا أسود. تبينت أنه سروال وجاكيت. خيل لي أنها ابتسمت لي لكنها لم تبعد الهاتف قليلا عن أذنها لتعانقني بحرارة المعتاد. في السابق كانت ترتدي ثيابا عادية وأقل صرامة، والآن تحولت لهذا النمط العجيب وصبغت شعرها الطويل باللون الأصفر. فاجأتني لأن الغالبية الساحقة من النساء اللواتي أعرفهن يتحولن منذ ثمانينات القرن الماضي إلى الحجاب ويلتجئن إلى الاحتشام الشديد بدل اللباس العصري. كنت أفكر بخصوصهن وأقول لنفسي إنهن طيبات وإن الحجاب هو مجرد إعلان عن حسن نية صادقة وغير مشروطة باعتبارهن مسؤولات بشكل مباشر عن إرساء دعائم السلم الاجتماعي في إطار مشروع التخفيف من التوتر الجنسي داخل الشارع العام، مضحيات بمظهرهن الخارجي على وعسى أن يكون لهذه التضحية نتيجة فعلية على أرض الواقع، هذا الواقع الغاص بالذئاب البشرية التي تتقمص أقنعة ذكور مسالمين. تبدو لبنى سريعة أكثر تماسكاً وسط الجلد مما كانت عليه وسط الثوب، ربما لأن الجلد كان ضيقاً. في ذلك المساء البعيد الذي سأفقد فيه وظيفتي في شركة الورق والتعليب، دست رأسها في صدري وعوض أن تدعني أبكي وأفرغ عليها قلبي، سبقتني وأخذت تنتحب وهي تخبرني أن طفلها الرضيع بعيد عنها عند والده، وأن المحامي الذي تبنى قضيتها يخدعها، وأن الرجال دين أمهم كلهم ولاد الحرام. كنا ننتظر القطار وكان المطر يغسل همومنا ويغسل إسفلت المحطة. Adam's Apple by Latifa Baka. I walk in and find the women there in the large hall. I can hear their soft, melodious voices, which means there is no man around. More accurately, there is no man doing all the talking. I instinctively head toward them like an animal finally encountering its species. I take a seat and wait for my turn. Before I came up to the therapist's clinic, I had run into Fast Lupna with the hazel eyes, the coal always smudged and the newly blonde hair outside the entrance. She was on the phone. She was dressed in black leather pants and a black leather jacket. I thought she smiled at me, but she didn't move the phone slightly away from her ear to give me a warm hug as she would have usually done. She used to dress more normally, less severely, before she adopted the style and dyed her long hair blonde. She surprises me. The transformation of the vast majority of women I know since the 80s of the last century has been toward the hijab and extreme modesty away from modern clothing. Open parentheses. When I think about them, I say to myself that they are good women, that the hijab is just the way of announcing their unconditional good intentions to the world, given the responsibility placed on their shoulders to ensure societal peace and eliminate sexual tension from public places. They sacrifice their appearance, hoping against hope that such sacrifice will have an effect on the ground, overcrowded as that ground is with wolves dressed as peaceful human males. Close parentheses. First Lupna appeared more solid in leather than she did in dress, possibly because of how tight the leather was. On that faraway evening, when I lost my job at the paper and packaging company, she buried her head in my chest, and instead of letting me cry and pour my heart out, she proceeded to sob as she told me that her only child, who was still an infant, was taken away from her by his father, that the lawyer she hired for the case was a crook, and that all men were assholes. We were waiting for the train, the rain washing our worries along with the station's asphalt.
Thanks for reading that. It was so nice to hear the Arabic as well. Could you describe what the piece is about and where it's set for those who may not have read it yet?
So I think it's set in a Moroccan city, but it's unnamed, I think. And it's kind of, there's if someone is more familiar with Morocco, they might be able to identify it by the only hint given to the location is the red, bright, like I think bright red taxis, group taxis as well. So that might be specific because I know that the colors of taxis are different from one city to another, but it could also like narrow it down to just a few cities. And it's a very introspective piece. So the narrator is walking into and then out of the therapist's office and then waits at the taxi rank where these kind of group taxis pick people up and then and it's just in conversation with herself and then occasionally with the reader. And probably it starts to feel after a while that the paragraphs and sentences and sometimes clauses of sentences and parentheses are probably addressed as an aside to the reader. I don't know if you've you're familiar with Fleabag, this British comedy.
Oh, the show. Yes.
The show, yeah. So,
I love it.
Yeah. So there is a sense of like, you know, when she looks at the camera and just says something aside to the, first time that happens in Fleabag, it's quite striking. And you get a similar sense with the story. There are sentences where you feel like she's turning straight at the reader and just like, oh, but by the way, here is what I think about women who wear the hijab.
Would you tell us a little bit about the process of translating this story, like how you start and how you finish up?
So one of the reasons I love translating short stories is that I can get through the first draft in one or two sittings. And I like if we're with longer tests, I start with a similar process as well. Like I like to translate without thinking initially. And that means that what comes out is not for sharing with anyone. Like even I can't read it properly to myself because it can be so messy with a lot of options for some words and kind of question marks. But I like doing that first for a first draft. And then with short stories like that are not too long, I can afford to finish the story in that form and then go back and do a bilingual reading, tweak a bit, and then put the Arabic aside and try to make the English work. But I feel that this initial kind of outpour of unthinking, like mirroring of the text, allows some things to stay in the end that are very close in structure and rhythm to the original, even if I wouldn't have been able to come up with them in English initially because they don't really sound completely right in English. But they create something new.
Oh, that's really interesting. I'm always interested when translators talk about sort of the stage where you can put away the original and just sort of work on the translation. Is that important? Is it important to like put some distance between them?
I think so, but also, I mean, it's a really tricky balance because I also don't want that distance to be too wide. So sometimes I go back to the Arabic, like at later editing stages, and there are bits in the text that I would mark for visiting and revisiting, and that revisiting involves going back to the Arabic and seeing it's like, oh, does it work in the same way? So to make the whole text work structurally and have an effect as the text in English, there is a stage where I put the Arabic aside and just focus on the English translation. That doesn't mean that I won't go back to the Arabic later because like as I hinted, like I like to allow some things to sneak through into the English that would not have, that if the story had been written in English, it would not have sounded like that. Like there's, you know, like, of course, like this is all very subjective and it's a very blurred line.
Right. Yeah. But it doesn't need to necessarily sound like it was written in English. It can sound like that there can be parts of it that are unusual or discomforting for a Western audience.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I like to think sometimes that, okay, there is no way, at least for me, to my ear, there is no way that this could have been written originally in English, which sometimes, you know, at least it used to be that the task of the translator was to make it sound like it was written originally in English. But I feel like, yeah, we wanted to work. We wanted to be enjoyable, but not sound, unless it's throughout, like it's been written originally in English.
Is there anything you can tell us about working with Hisham Boussani, who's our fiction editor? Like, is that a different step that you wouldn't normally go through with a story?
I think having a bilingual editor is amazing. And it's something that needs to be part of every translation process, because translation does feel like, you know, any good writing is a collaboration between, you know, at least two people. There's the person who produces the text and then an editor, and a good editor is essential really for something to work. But I've really enjoyed working with bilingual editors. And when I first had something published in The Common, which was, 2015, I think that might have been my first experience of having someone who's actually from the publisher side, like not a colleague translator that I asked to look over the text for me, but someone like, you know, working with, having the bilingual editing as incorporated in the editing process by the publishers. And I thought that was, and also like the whole experience where I'm working with Jennifer Acker, the whole experience was, I kept citing it afterwards as one of my best editing experiences. So I think that a big part of it is this attention given to like, okay, this is a text that also has a source. And bilingual editors do that and bring that into the process.
So I feel that some of the pieces you translated for us have such a beautiful, dreamy, poetic feel to them, almost like they're blurring the lines between prose and poetry. And I was just thinking, like, can you talk a little bit about getting the tone of a piece right so it matches maybe the original author's intentions? Like, what choices do you make when you're translating, when you're trying to sort of preserve a feeling or the mood of a work?
I started literary translation by dabbling in poetry. And I say dabbling because it never feels like, translating a poem never feels that you've done it justice. So I don't know, there's an organization in London called the Poetry Translation Center, and they organize workshops where they bring in kind of literally translated texts, like gloss translations from various languages, and the focus is on non-European texts. So it could be in a European language, but from outside Europe. So like the idea was kind of introduce poetry that English readers wouldn't have necessarily come across. And I start when I, before I got into translation, when I was working in other things completely, 2005, I think, was when I first became aware of them, and I started attending those workshops. And I was like, oh, I really enjoy this process. So I started translating poetry. And I feel that there is the site, like the translation of the sound and rhythm of sentences that has stayed with me from like my initial pull to poetry. It's just something that I almost dread looking more closely at the process, because I know that if I do that, I will never be satisfied with the result. But there are very few occasions, like very, very few, like there, you can find a sentence in when I'm asked to read something after I also it's very, you know, it's very rare that I would go back and just read what I've translated after it's been published. Out for fun, because that's just self-torture, I think. But sometimes I just come across a sentence that, okay, like I actually like that works for me in English in the same way that it works in Arabic. Well, of course, I notice that in other translators work a lot more. But the sound and the rhythm, the music of the sentence, that's, to get that, I read aloud is one thing. And that initial kind of dumping down like everything on the page draft, I think helps with that, because then you have those, you have the breaks and I duplicate the punctuation and stuff, and also like, of course that changes later, because whatever effect something has in like the effect of short sentences in Arabic, for instance, is not the same as the effect of short sentences, like, you know, the effect of long sentences, like really sentences that go over several lines with commas, that's quite common in Arabic. Well, if you do that in English, it will feel like a stylistic choice. So things change after a while, but when I start very close, or the translation is very close to the original, it allows me it helps me get some of the rhythm across. And I think, like, if that works, and if you say that you read the English translation and find and get that poeticness out of it, then that means that, yeah, maybe it did work to an extent.
Right. So there are moments where you're making exact word choices or debating using one word or another, but really it sounds like it's much more holistic and a little bit of a softer process.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, there are words that you feel, oh, this, I really have to get this word right because it means so much in the context of the sentence or the paragraph. But I think mostly what I focus on and where I feel like the moment I feel satisfied with something is when I feel like, okay, it's getting close to the overall rhythm and sound. And sometimes it's to do with having like alliterations, for instance, or having like feeling that the sound of a sentence carries the heaviness of a situation in Arabic. And then like, okay, what letters do I need to kind of to have an abundance of in the sentence to make it sound heavy? I don't know. Like I just have an example in mind now from another story in the same issue, from the first sentence of Abdelaziz al-Rashidi's The Sting, which is a very short piece. Yeah, so it's just like that had a lot of two S sounds in the Arabic, like S and Th. So seen is like the S, the standard S sound, and then there's a Th, which is like TH. It's describing sleep, and it's kind of, it just sounded to me, that sounded in Arabic like it was very heavy with sleep, like the repetition of these sounds. Hold on, maybe I'll just actually read it in Arabic first as well. Yeah, the repetition of these sounds in Arabic just really made you feel like you were experiencing that quiet and heaviness of the night. نومٌ ثقيل وظلمة كثيفة تسور المكان تغلف وجوم المساحة تمت السماء أيضا متهللة مشرعة داحقة. So it's almost happened in the translation before I noticed that, and then I noticed it and tried to push it further. But what I ended up with is heavy sleep, a dense darkness fences the place, wraps around its silence. There's also the sky, exultant, expectant. And so, yeah, so I can't do that, for every sentence, but sometimes a sentence strikes me in the original, and then it feels like it just has to make it through, especially like this is the opening sentence, it sets the scene. And you want this kind of, it sets a scene of this kind, like mix of calm and being lulled into something, into the story maybe, but also a heaviness and a bit like a sense of being trapped maybe slightly. So it felt, yeah, it felt like a repetitions of sounds would achieve that effect in the sentence. So yeah, so these are the things that I stop at and then like try go keep going back to get a certain effect.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Oh, that's so great. I'm so glad you had that example for us. That definitely makes it a little more clear to me what exactly you're doing on sort of the line level. So these pieces appear in a portfolio of writing that we published from Morocco, and you translated three pieces for it. I was wondering, do you feel like the pieces you translated share any common themes or similarities? Do you have a certain sense of Morocco or Moroccan writing after working on these pieces?
My instinctive reaction to say no, not really. I don't know. I think they're actually quite different. There are two that are that have an urban setting, but Latifa Baka, who I read from earlier, which her story is mainly an introspective story. So it's mainly the narrator having conversations with herself and with the reader, and the city around her is almost incidental. It's just a source of stimulants that act on her, and then she responds to them. While the other story, pieces with the urban setting, came from Abdellatif El Drissi. I think there are two or three interconnected pieces, and these are very they're very explicitly set in Tangier. He doesn't name the city, but they're very direct clues. And I've never been to Tangier actually, but he was referring to very specific landmarks, and there is a cafe where a lot of the characters appear. And when I Googled that and I found it immediately, like this, the exact plaza where that cafe is with all the landmarks around it. So it's very, and also there's talk about migration through the city. And so that's like very much connected with with the place, with the specific city, and all the characters, you feel like they're types that you would encounter in particular locales in the city. So it is very much about the place. And the third author, Abdelaziz Rashidi, his pieces are also kind of centering around place, but that place is a desert. So there's two short pieces, and each of them deals with desert communities in different ways. It's very much about the nature of the desert. There's in one of them, the one that I read the first line from, a scorpion features very centrally. So it's very much about the nature and the harshness of nature and the things that people have to deal with in a desert surrounding. So they're quite they don't really give me an idea of Morocco. I'm not going to go to Morocco and feel like I know it better now. And I think there's a sense of place, but also this is probably something that happens a lot more in short stories, like the strong sense of place, because you need to pull the reader in very quickly. And so you need to give them a clear sense of where they are, to get into the story quickly. Sense of place in short stories, I think, tends to be generally more powerful. But I think it's also important to reflect critically about what we expect when we read translated literature, what we expect to learn about the places that the literature comes from. And like, it's, you know, a piece of fiction is not, it's not the Lonely Planet, basically. They all have a sense of place, but they're different. They're different, and the authors have very different styles, and the settings of the stories are also quite different.
Yeah, I think I do tend to agree with you. The pieces did not feel like they were, you know, terribly similar in any obvious way. I was just not sure if I was missing something obvious that you had connected them with. But yeah, you know, I also think just reading the portfolio as a whole, I think there is just this enormous range of material and places and cities and deserts and a huge range in there. So I think that that in itself is important. Yeah.
Yeah, Morocco is a big country with multiple languages as well and dialects, the literary history there in itself is so very, like, we're not even touching on the possibilities of different genres of writing and schools of writing that, you know, so it was just like, these are stories that I think should be read for their own right, not as representative of Morocco.
Yeah, they don't need to be a snapshot of Morocco as a whole, So this isn't your first time having work in the common, because you also translated a story by Mona Merhi for issue 11, which was our first issue focused on Arabic fiction and translation. And that came out in 2016, so I'm assuming you probably translated the piece in 2015, which is 6 years ago, believe it or not. And I was just wondering if you felt like much has changed in the world of translation since then, maybe in terms of either practices or ethos, or you were talking about this different feeling, like things don't need to sound as English anymore as they do now. Like, are there things that you feel like are shifting over time in that world?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think two things have happened. And I, you know, by no means saying that they started after 2015 or 16.
Sure, of course.
It's just that these, there are conversations that are becoming more prominent in the translation world, or trends. And one is translators reflecting on their own subjectivity. And so there are texts that have come out by translators about the translation craft. And I until a few years ago, I wasn't aware of like a wealth of such writing in English, at least. I think in French, maybe there were things that kind of writing started earlier. But I think it feels like it's taking up more space in English in the past few years. It's a trend that definitely foregrounds the translator's subjectivity. And with that, probably interconnected to that, with that came the other change, that's an awareness of the ethical responsibility of the translator. Because if we are allowed to make creative choices, because everyone is talking about this now, and it's kind of, you know, it's kind of cool now to be a creative translator, and it's not like your only remit is not to just produce something that's very close to the original, but also there's an acknowledgement of the individual style that a translator might bring, and the different ways that different translators would hear and experience and interpret a text differently. So with that also comes an acknowledgement of there are certain ethical choices that we can make or ignore to make in the translation itself. The awareness of power hierarchies between language, and especially when translating into English, this feels like a really present thing, because English is ubiquitous. English is is a larger than life language. And it's so easy to just submit to the norms of a language like that. So to what extent are we allowed to maybe push against the seams? It's a stylistic choice, but it's also an ethically informed stylistic choice. And I think there are a lot more interesting conversations happening you know, in like the area of decolonizing translation, and what does it mean, and how does literary translation link to other forms of translation that were very much part of a colonial practice, and what do we need to strip away to free ourselves from that? It's very much. It's a very needed effort to be made, and I don't think it's new. I just think in the past few years, this conversation has become louder. So it feels like it's now having an effect on actually how we translate and the kind of things that publishers look for and the kind of things that publishers might allow a translator to do in their work.
I feel like there's like a little more space for those conversations, you know, in all parts of the world right now. So I hope that, I hope that's having an effect on what publishers are considering and choosing to publish. Yeah. So I know you also translate from English into Arabic, which made me wonder if there's anything much different about that process compared to translating from Arabic into English. Like, is one easier than the other?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but can I actually add something to the last?
Oh, yes. Question? Oh, yes. Sorry. Yes, go ahead.
No, because I just remembered the story that I translated for The Common in 2016 was cool. Like, I just remember very clearly that one thing that I was so happy to be able to get away with, and that's like completely, you know, to the credit of The Common editors, is that I coined a word for the title. Is the title, so it was published under the title Haphazardia. I don't think that's a word that exists in English. But it was it's a translation of a word that in Arabic, and especially in Egypt, where the story was set, is ashwaiyat, which means unlicensed housing areas, like quote unquote slum areas, but the word in Arabic has at its core a root word that means arbitrary, haphazard, and that really meant something to the story, because the story was all revolving around this idea of like randomness. So I came up with this word, and there was some discussion around it, and I was just so pleased to get away with it.
That's great. Do you think maybe that's something you wouldn't have got away with like a couple of years before?
maybe that's a sign. That was a sign of like things beginning to shift in the translation world.
Oh, that's so fun. I'm so glad that you told us that. So now let me just ask you again, like about English into Arabic, Arabic into English. Like, is there a difference in that translation process?
So when I work into English at the moment, that's mostly literary fiction and poetry. That's what I translate from Arabic into English. And most of what I translate from English into Arabic is more cultural production content. So things for museums, exhibition, catalogs, you know, kind of essays, things like that. It shifts sometimes. So there have been instances where things shifted in either direction, and it might shift more in the future. It kind of depends on so many factors, really. But it's taken me a very long time to embrace the fluidity of my relationship to the languages that I use and live with. And I think that's... it's quite tricky because it's not... and again, this probably links to the shift that might be happening in the translation world in general. The emphasis on having to translate into quote unquote your mother tongue is also changing slightly, because a lot of people do not have that clear relationship to one language, and this is like unequivocally the first language. People like the migrant experience means that we have shifting relationships with different languages all the time. And, you know, people grow up and live in and through different languages depending on so many other factors of what's happening in their lives. So this idea of like one, the mother, like your mother tongue being also, and also like, you know, some people could have, their mother tongue could be different from their father tongue. So like when they could grow up speaking three languages at home. So where do you draw the line of? So, and I think this is, it's strange because you think that translation, literary translation is something that's, so it's so open, like it's based on a premise of being open to influences from all over the world. But paradoxically, I feel that it's been quite late in catching up with the questioning of certain givens about where, you know, where people come from and where reside and where they reside and how we're not like, you know, like it's, we're not just a collection of disconnected nation states where translation is the only bridge. You know, like some of us also like, you know, are on the bridge most of our lives. So I think because, yeah, like my relationship with Arabic and English and also German is always in flux. And maybe one day I'll be translating more fiction out of English into Arabic, who knows?
So when I was in London, one of my absolute favorite places was the British Library, and you're the Arabic translation manager for the library. Can you tell me more about what that means, what sort of things you're working on?
Yeah, I am. So I've been working on, I've been managing the translation team for a digitization project that's been running since 2012 or 13. Went live at the end of 2014, and it's an online archive which has different types of content, but they all revolve around the Arab world, but also specifically the Gulf area. It's a partnership between the project is based on a partnership between the British Library and the Qatar National Library, so it's like two national libraries coming together and pulling the resources and kind of making things from the archives available. The bulk of what's on it at the moment is IOR files, which are India Office records. So that's basically, these are basically files that document the British colonial presence in the Gulf area. So like, you know, some things date back to the like 15th century. 15, maybe that's a bit too far. Definitely 17th century and up until like the mid to late 20th century. So it's quite, you know, it's like there's a wealth of information there, but it's also like the archives that the British Library alone has are endless. There's also some, like in that regard, like just the India Office records. And it's, there's stuff that's really fascinating because you get like letters between, you know, like some official in sitting in a, you know, so like in London, like I've never been to the area, but kind of writing a letter about what they should do about a particular problem there. So it's kind of, it just gives an insight on the kind of the bureaucracy of colonialism almost. There are also Arabic scientific manuscripts. So like things from, you know, like old manuscripts. The library has so many, like gems of those that are like difficult to find anywhere else. So we basically, what this project does is like puts up digital copies of these resources online so they can be accessed from anywhere in the world. And where my part comes in is we build a bilingual archive around it. So the catalog descriptions, detailed catalog descriptions of everything go up both in English and Arabic. And so far, I think there are over 2 million pages online in this project. And it's still the only in-house translation dedicated team at the British Library. And it was the first fully bilingual project to be kind of like built this way, or like built where translation is built in the entire process of archiving and digitizing. So yeah, I'm quite proud to have played a part in setting that up.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And I love that they're being digitized too. I think one of my experiences of working at the British Library when I was doing research was that it wasn't super accessible. So I like the idea of things going online. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's definitely a move towards that in the whole of like the library libraries field. You know, there's a lot of digital archives that exist, and it's also feel quite in time for lockdowns. Like last year really these things came into their own. Like you realized how valuable it was to be able for researchers to be able to continue some of their work without leaving their homes.
I don't mean to bash the British Library. This was a long time ago when I was doing research.
No, believe me, it's so
like much longer than I think. I'm sure they're much more on it now.
I'm not going to dispute that publicly. Oh, that's quite a change of subject. We went. Okay. This is not an easy one to think about or respond to. It's fine. It's fine. If I were to write an addendum now, the first thing that comes to mind would be to write about political prisoners. In the past 6-7 years, especially, there's been an explosion of prison industrial complexes in Egypt. It's I think, don't quote me on that, but I don't. The resources are there. The resources online from human rights organizations, but just the number that I remember is like a conservative number of new prisons that have been built is around 20. It's probably some sources will tell you more. And you see in state-run media, like these kind very celebratory headlines, being announcing new modern prisons. So it's kind of like there's definitely this is a thing that's been happening, and there's a very high number of political prisoners, and some of them held for nothing but having family connections to groups that are opposed to the government or that the government has issues with. Some have been held for months or years pending investigation into either fictional or very petty charges. Some serve their sentence, get released, and then get arrested straight away a few weeks later. And again, detained awaiting something that doesn't happen. So it's kind of like, it's kind of heartbreaking to think of that in contrast with the moment that I was writing in 2011. And it's, I think, thinking back to that time, there was a very strong sense of possibility, and things have opened up now. And I think a big part of that was from being just the experiential effect of having lived for a few weeks in the lived reality of the daily lived reality during the sit-ins, etc., was one that had a lot of elements from what maybe might become a better world. And of course that didn't last. Even on the ground there were so many complications as well. But there was definitely a sense of possibility. Whatever I wrote about it at the time, that came from a very strong sense of the possibilities are endless, and it's very difficult to get access to that now. However, I would not want to, because I can't think about Egypt without thinking of political prisoners. This is really the top issue at the moment. But also there's another not unconnected point that I want to bring up is which I, you know, I don't think was like would have been like it would definitely would it definitely would have been present at the time, and it was present in a lot of the coverage as well. But I don't think I think if I write something now, I would foreground it a lot more, and that's the global interconnectedness of injustice and oppression everywhere. And it's kind of, it became like the way that played out in Egypt's political situation was that, like, of course it wasn't going to, like, suddenly this country, this like little country is like minor player in the global field, was not going to be suddenly fix itself completely in, you know, in isolation from the rest of the world. It mattered to the established powers only as something was a stable interface. So, you know, regardless of what happens, whatever chaos, lawlessness, oppression is happening behind that stable interface does not matter. And for that to change, the world needs to change in many ways. And I think so all the injustices that, you know, economic, social, racial, that we face everywhere are global struggles. They're not local struggles. And and something like the pandemic made us, you know, give us a taste of that. There are probably going to be more. Sorry, I'm just going really pessimistic on you now. But I also sometimes like thinking about these like global catastrophes, like climate catastrophes have already begun to happen. Like, these things, when they happen, they intensify existing injustices. And sometimes I feel that like our civilization is running out of time, like to fix the existing injustices, so that when shit hits the fan, we can deal with it in a.
I just have one last question. We always end by asking, you know, what you're working on, what's next from you. Is there anything you want to tell us about?
So yeah, so I because I'm juggling lots of things, and I have lots of work hats. So I'm, you know, 3 days a week I work at the British Library, and there are other things as well. So I initially I started translating short stories because it was they were the only things that I could fit in, and now I feel that I've become really attached to the genre, like reading, writing, and translating it. So I have a few more short stories coming up in the Palestine feature with The Common, actually, I think later this year. I'm working on them now. And there is an anthology coming soon from Strangers Press, which is part of the University of East Anglia publishing arm. It's translated together with Sabat Hossein and edited by Garan Torikian. It's an anthology of writers who write in Arabic primarily in the diaspora and primarily from Africa. So Arabic authors from Africa, but based away from wherever their original home was. And other than translation related project that I'm involved in at the moment and have been for the past year is working with an organization called Shadow Heroes to run translation workshops in schools. So it's a way to bring translation, but also less known languages or lesser known languages and forms of writing and like stories and lyrics and like, you know, from parts of the world that are not normally foregrounded in the classroom. They would not necessarily be new and unfamiliar for all the students in the classroom, but they're not normally or not often something that gets covered as part of the curriculum. Right. So I'm working with Shadow Heroes as curating some of these workshops and running one of them also about Arabic comics.
That sounds great.
These are the things I'm working on right now.
You sound busy.
Well, yeah. I need a holiday, definitely.
That just sounds great. So Nariman Yusuf, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really great talking with you.
Thank you so much, Emily. It's been a real pleasure. And I feel that the conversation could have gone on for another hour.
We certainly could have kept going, yeah. Listeners, you can read Nariman's translations and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.